Looking to start a podcast but don't know where to begin? Look no further. The team at Dodge Media Productions has 20 years of experience as podcast listeners and observing the industry and 8 years experience in podcast production. We can help you take your podcast from idea to fruition and we'll make the process seamless and easy. We'll help you with everything from recording and editing to hitting the charts on Apple Podcasts. So what are you waiting for? Contact us today and let's get started. DodgeMediaProductions.com.
You're listening to Dodge Movie Podcast. Your hosts are Christy and Mike Dodge, the founders of Dodge Media Productions. We produce films and podcasts, so this is a podcast about films. Join them as they share their passion for filmmaking.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Dodge Movie Podcast. This is episode 167. We are talking about a classic today, the 1965 The Sound of Music.
Fun fact is very high probability that if I was on Lip Sync Battle, one of my two songs would be from this
one. Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one is available on Disney Plus, but we had to fork over $4 for it because we don't have a subscription. So if you have Disney Plus, please enjoy The Sound of Music. The director was Robert Wise, who I had never heard of, but has quite a credited career. The Day the Earth Stood Still in 1951. I've, of course, heard of his 1961 West Side Story. You had heard of 1971, The Andromeda Strain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then he also did 1979 Star Trek, The Motion Picture. It stars Julia Andrews, Christopher Plummer, and a bunch of kids.
Yeah.
The DP was Ted D. McCord, who did The Treasure of Sierra Madre, which I had heard of from 1948, and East of Eden from 1955. This film was largely filmed in Salzburg, Austria, and some parts were filmed in Germany. The writer is George Herdeleck, although it's not spelled, it's, how do you pronounce George without the E at the end?
Georg is how I've heard it.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting because Captain Von Trapp's first name, I don't know if it really is Georg or is this just a coincidence or did the writer say, I'm going to make the handsome lead Georg?
I think it was historically accurate. I think the historic Von Trapp captain was
just Georg. A common name, apparently.
Yeah. George, you know, it's
well, every time the Baroness would say it, I thought she was saying Gaylord.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
Because I wasn't familiar with that pronunciation. So the other writer is Howard Lindsay and Russell Krause. The synopsis for this film is a young novice is sent by her convent in the 1930s Austria to become a governess to 7 children of a widowed naval officer. Okay, I don't even know if we're going to do this quick. There are so many taglines, I'm not going to even stop to count them all.
Okay.
The first one. Radiance that floods the screen and warms the heart. The more you see it, the more it becomes one of your favorite things. That one, I mean, is kind of true.
It's but calling back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. There was a re-release in Australia in Christmas of 1971, a wonderful year. And it was a Christmas welcome back to the happiest holiday sound.
Huh.
The wait is over. You can thrill again to the happiest sound in all the world.
Huh.
That was another...
re-release, obviously.
Yeah. El gran clásico que toda familia debe compartir.
Hmm.
That's in Spanish. That's the best my high school Spanish can give you. With songs that have sung for 1,000 years.
Oh, that's better.
So now I think it's a bunch of lyrics. My heart wants to sing every song it hears.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The hills are alive with the sound of music.
Mm-hmm.
The hills fill my heart with the sound of music. The happiest sound in all the world. That's probably the best one so far.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The happiest classic every family should share. That's a 2000 video release.
Mm.
So did any of those move your needle? Did any of them want to make you rush out and watch it?
Well, I think of all of those, The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Music, because that is probably the most famous lyric from this film. It's hard to get past that. Now, it's interesting that it kept talking about happy, happy, happy with this movie. One of the bits of trivia that I read was if the Ruskies had nuked Britain, the BBC was going to put this on to try to cheer people up.
Wow.
They had that chambered.
That's so funny because as we watched this, we talked about, well, first of all, hold your seats, everybody.
Holding.
3 hours long.
It is so long, it has an intermission.
Yeah, and neither one of us remembered. We remembered that about midway through, we kind of got bored, but couldn't really put our finger on why before we watched it.
Mm-hmm.
After we have some thoughts. But
right.
But this is a film about a family who is trying to escape Austria so they don't get killed by Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
How is this the happiest movie?
Well, they get away.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah, well, except for, poor Max.
Okay, so that first scene that we all remember where she's, rolling around in the grass on the mountain singing that iconic song, that scene is actually in Bavaria, Germany.
Oh, okay.
That specific scene. And then I just was going to say that the real Maria von Trapp claimed that this movie toned down her behavior during her stay at the Abbey, that when she was asked in interview if she was really that bad, she joked, "I was worse."
And I wonder if that comes, there's a line in there where the captain says, "Were you this much trouble at the Abbey?" And she says, "Oh, much more, sir."
Yeah.
And I wondered if the screenwriter put that in after talking to Maria for a while. He's like, okay.
Kick us off with your pickup line for this film.
Well, this one is sung. The hills are alive with the sound of music, with songs they have sung for 1,000 years.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, this movie, I mean, despite it being 3 hours, that opening scene is gorgeous. I mean, we see like the Alps and kind of a fjord-like looking.
So credit to Wise here, because I guarantee you back in, what's it, 62?
No, I think 65.
In 65, helicopter shots were not cheap.
Right.
And he put that company in business. There were helicopter shots of all kinds of fjord-like looking things. I think they're called fjords there, but nonetheless.
The Alps.
The Alps, mountains and lakes and rivers and schlosses and all that. And then later in town, there are still some shots that are obviously helicopter shots. So, and of course, it's kind of humorous that when Julie Andrews is singing, she apparently got blown down a lot by it. And then we noticed at the last scene when they're hiking out, you can see the prop wash of the helicopter. It's very obvious that it's squishing the grass down.
Not just like the wind.
Yeah. But, great. He embraced that. It was like the GoPro of his day. It was a technological wonder, I guess. And he really, and when you think about it, for a motor vehicle, that the shots were really still. They looked much better than the handheld stuff we see today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just beautiful. And like you talked about, there were scenes where they'd use the gels to make Julie Andrews just look dreamy.
Yeah.
And, Liesl's eyes would pop when they would, in the scene where she's singing with Rolf. Beautiful cinematography. And like the home that they're in is, just this opulence. The dinner where the children perform, everybody's dressed to like the nines. I mean, it's just.
Oh, and one thing I mentioned whilst we were watching this is the song Do Re Mi. They shoot so many different setups for that because they're trying to show that she's taking the kids through town like over a week or two.
Right.
But it's like 4 or 5 seconds at most with some of these setups. And you've got 8 people that have to go through hair and makeup. You've got all the extras, all of the crew for 4 seconds on screen. So this guy Wise had a big budget and he used it. So credit to him.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I did notice kind of skipping ahead a little bit to costuming because we're talking about kind of the look of everything. Everybody's clothing is kind of muted and it's in this very brown palette, maybe some mustard color thrown in, or maybe like a very deep sage green. But it wasn't until the Baroness comes out onto the balcony and she's wearing a red dress that I realized the lack of color, that there is kind of like like the children almost quite literally blend into the wall. Like, you know, I know she made their clothing out of the drapes, but.
So obviously the costumers did that on purpose. Everything in the film is on purpose. But if you look, of course, Lederhosen have a very light brown, gray, mouse brown kind of color with some green accents. And then there's apparently a suit that is traditional there. And the jacket is also that color. And so when you see Max, his suits are this like gray, light gray. Like apparently it seems like that was, at least in part, natural for that period in Austria. But yes, then it makes it pop. And that way we also notice when Maria comes back from the Abbey, in that green dress. And the kids are singing and they're sad. And then she comes back and starts singing with them. I get misty-eyed now. And yeah. I did when we watched it again.
Yeah.
I knew it was going to happen. I knew she would be with them at the end, and it still got me.
Uh-huh. But it just, it was really fascinating throughout most of the film, except for her green dress, except for the Baroness's red dress. I think near the end when they're fleeing, she might have a bit of a yellow sweater on. But once again, I feel like it's, you know.
Yeah, the colors were muted. But of course, the Nazi flag was red, but so was the Austrian red and white flag.
Yeah.
So that made them pop a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't even thought of that. And then some of the big scenes out there, like that gazebo, it was always shot at night.
Uh-huh.
And so there wasn't a lot of color.
Everything's pretty dark. Yeah. So except for that opening scene that is beautiful with like the bright blue sky.
And the green hills.
Yeah. And so it's just fascinating because like you said, I knew all of that was intentional and purposeful and specific.
I've had a costumer tell me that nowadays they source most of the clothing. And when I look at this film, I just have this feeling that it wasn't all sourced, that they made a lot of this stuff for them. And it's better for it, in my opinion. I agree with you. I really like what the wardrobe department did.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm thinking about it and Julie was often in kind of, if she was in a color, it was like a bluish green because I'm thinking of that scene where the Baroness comes out in her red dress and he's standing on the balcony and Maria is conflicted. And so she has walked out and she's in like this very pale blue.
Yeah, light blue. Yeah, yeah. So that scene is interesting. It's one of these things where you watch a movie over and over again and you notice new things. Each time, kind of thing. I really like the way they did that because I think a lot of other films would have dragged on him staring with googly eyes at Maria and the Baroness maybe not noticing at first and then maybe suspecting and blah, blah, and then she'd be catty and all this back and forth. It was, I thought, very realistic. He's staring googly eyes at the hot governess out there in silhouette. And the Baroness walks up and she can do the math.
Mm-hmm.
I like that she wasn't dumb.
Mm-hmm.
She was a smart character and the actress did a great job, but she was obviously trying to preserve her pride.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't need you. You're not, you know, you're too independent. I thought that scene was so well done because it kind of wrapped up that plot arc, but it did so. It wasn't peremptory. It was just cleanly done and didn't drag out. I thought this was really well done.
It didn't drag out, but I thought the other thing that scene did really well is first Maria walks out. So the audience is identifying with her and we know why she's out there looking pensive because she doesn't feel
well.
Is that after she came back?
Yeah, that's after she came back, believe. And she thinks he's going to marry the Baroness. And so she's heartbroken.
She's like, what do I do? I love the children. I miss the children. I've now come back and I enjoy being with the children, but he's obviously marrying the Baroness. So what am I going to do?
Right.
So we identify with her and what plight she's in.
Right.
Then we see him walk out and now we're like, we're feeling what he's feeling. Oh my gosh, what am I going to do?
Right.
I'm engaged to the Baroness, but look, there's Fräulein Maria looking so beautiful in the moonlight.
Yeah. I should go smooch her.
I really have eyes for her. And then we see the Baroness walk out and we're like you said, we know immediately what she knows.
Right.
And we're like, how dare you? You know, kind of.
Yeah.
We see her perspective.
Yeah, it's just, again, this is a great film, and there's a reason for it.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so like you said last week, Dame Julie Andrews learned the guitar especially for this movie.
As did Christopher Plummer.
That's impressive.
Right.
As someone who has tried to learn just the ukulele and failed.
Right. So, unfortunately for Mr. Plummer, neither his guitar playing nor his singing made the final cut. I don't know if he knew while they were filming that they were going to dub him later, but, and nothing against him. He, I'm sure, sings much better than, or sang much better than I do, but they apparently got a fellow who was in a band that was well known at the time to dub his singing for him.
So you always told me this, and I have since read it, so that Christopher Plummer was not happy about
now this
is, role.
This is fascinating.
Yeah.
Because I have read so much over the years, and from piecing it together of things he said, I think at the time he didn't, but much like in real life, Maria grew to love the captain, I think he grew to love the role of the captain over time. And in one of the interviews that I read, he admitted that at the time they were making this, he had been doing a lot of stage work in London, and he said he was spoiled and arrogant when he approached this role. So I think at the time he didn't like it, but then over the years, I think he changed. He changed as a person, and mm-hmm. also he saw probably the film in a new light, and all these other things would happen.
Well, and I would think that so many people probably approach him and tell him how much they love this movie, that maybe, like you said, maturity and seeing it through other people's eyes and seeing how much, I mean, I told you this is one of my really good friends. It's like her favorite film of all time. There have been sing-alongs, you know, made out of this. There, mm-hmm. it's been not remade, but they didn't they do the live version?
Yeah, on Carrie Underwood.
Yeah,
right.
So, I mean, this is such a beloved movie that you would have to kind of stop, and even if you had a negative experience, I'm trying to think that one movie that I worked on in 2017. If enough people came up and were just like, this movie changed my life, or, oh my gosh, this movie gave me hope, or like, would I probably would see it in a different light. Like, I'm only thinking of the making of it, but
right.
what this movie is meaning for all these people.
Right.
I guess you kind of.
But I want to give Mr. Plummer credit that he admitted that when he was younger, you know, he had a bit of attitude, and I think all of us we're susceptible to that. We're humans.
Yeah.
But you're right. When you are involved in something that is this beloved, how can you? It's like if you're in Star Wars, right? You're like, okay, maybe I was irritated at the time, but this thing is a cultural phenomenon. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Right?
And so I remember this movie, you know, we're really going to date ourselves here. Long before even the VHS, right? Before VCRs came out. This movie was on like once a year. I'm trying to think,
yes.
Was it Christmas time or was it, I think
it may have been, but I don't know. It was on television.
It was.
Now, this movie is almost 3 hours long, just theatrically.
So
when you do commercials.
Yeah, but I think what they did is it would be like GM sponsors,
Right.
So I don't think they did commercials maybe, or maybe if they did,
right.
it was only like a GM commercial or something.
During the intermission, I think they played like, you know, brought to you by General Motors.
I just wonder
but
if it
was 3 hours. It was like a whole block.
Because if they did commercials, it would have been like 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, it would have been.
If you think about it.
Cray cray. But it was an event.
And so watching it this time, I really tried to pay attention. Like, what are the scenes that I don't remember, because obviously I remember all of the singing scenes. I mean, we turned this movie into a sing-along when we watched it the other day.
Yes.
Because the songs are just so iconic and they're so great.
Right. I was stunned at how many of these songs I knew.
I was stunned at the unpopular ones that you knew.
Yes. So to be fair, I have
like
heard
the one that the nun sings her?
Which one?
When she goes, weren't you singing that one?
Well, yes.
It's the one when she goes back And she's been called down to the nun's office, and she knows she's going to get in trouble.
Now, climb every mountain. Yeah.
Yes. And you were singing that one. Like, lyrics, do you... I know you listen to soundtracks, but so this is in the rotation.
Yes. Apparently. I was surprised. I think if we went and asked Steve how much I've listened to this, it would be probably... hundreds just from iTunes alone.
Okay, but I started to say the scenes that weren't, that did not have songs.
Right.
I was really trying to pay attention because it's like, is this when I just ducked out as a kid? And then when maybe like I'd go to my room and then when I heard them singing, I'd come running back in or something because we couldn't fast forward.
I don't think there's anything in there that I said, I don't remember this.
Oh, I know there is. There was a scene where the Baroness and him were talking, and I don't really remember that one. But the scene that I really didn't remember and was so poignant because as an adult now, with an adult frame of reference, with an understanding of history, with an understanding of what went down, like with the Nazis and stuff, I do not remember the scene where they're trying to tiptoe out of the yard.
Oh, really?
And the guards are there and they're like, what's going on?
Right. Okay.
I don't remember that scene. And I know as a kid, I would not have understood what the gravity of that was, how scary that was.
I certainly didn't understand how scary that was. It for me as a kid, it just played as you got caught.
Yeah.
You know, like, but no, I remember it at all, which along with my ability to sing even the not popular songs... As we discussed during and after filming, it's surprising that people thought I was a friend of Dorothy when I was a 16-year-old boy who could sing the entire soundtrack. But
of Sound of Music.
Yeah.
Or any soundtrack.
Well, at least the films I know.
Right.
It's interesting. I thought there would be more in there that I'd be like, nah. There's nothing that I thought, I didn't see that before. I recognize him. But like you said, they landed differently with... being older and having more life experience and more understanding of kind of the political situation at the time that I didn't get as a kid.
And so this one is much like, I guess, Star Wars. We talked about a movie recently. It must have been, it was Star Wars, that really any age can kind of enjoy because kids don't understand the gravity, but we understand that there's a babysitter who comes in that sometimes maybe you don't like and you play tricks on. But then sometimes she sings you a song and you're like, I kind of like her. Right. Or even just the appeal of here's a film with kids in it. Uh-huh. And there's all these different kids age and boys ranges. And girls. So you have teenagers that can relate to Liesel.
Do you like Kurt or do you like Friedrich?
Yeah. Right. Gretel's so cute.
Oh, so cute.
And so I wonder if this is one of those, if we could go back, but they wouldn't have the numbers on it, is... how many kids came to this, movie? Was this just strictly an adult movie? I mean, by the time it was on TV, it was the whole family would sit down and watch this movie.
I remember sitting on the couch and watching this film on television when it came on
each
year. And
the adults are enjoying it as much as the kids are. Although maybe the kids are bored at times and run to the room and then come back when they hear singing.
Except for some of the kids that apparently sat there and learned all the songs, but that's not important right now.
What stood out for you watching it this time?
Well, when I was a kid, I, of course, did not look at this from a narrative film perspective. And this time, the opening scene doesn't necessarily show us a whole lot about Maria. But almost immediately, she tells us in her confession with a Reverend Mother that music is her thing. Like, I didn't get that as a kid. They just tell us directly. She says, the reason I came to the nunnery is because you were singing. And I love music, and that's my life. And so it's like, name is the sound of music,
well,
right?
And she did, I feel like when she first ran in because she was late, she said the hills were calling to me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So they use the nuns for exposition.
Yeah.
Because
first song.
Yeah, each nun gets to kind of
tell
you a little bit about her.
Yeah.
And you have the different perspectives.
But even, yes, and... the different nuns give you a different take because Maria makes me laugh. And, like, it's like, there's the grouchy nun. Like, she's late for...
Sister Karen.
Right. Like, she's late for me. And she's scowly, But for the most part, people are like, oh, you know, Maria's Maria. Like,
yeah.
like they love her in spite of maybe her nonconformist ways in the right. nun, the nunnery or the convent.
And it's good that you brought up Sister Karen, because again, this is a thing I didn't think about, but as an actor, you don't, you know, your character is your character, but that character, Sister Karen, at the end, she steals the distributor. So yes. she breaks the rules.
Yes.
Like, this is the person who has been so adamant about the rules. Wow. And then she's willing to steal to protect them.
Yeah.
So it's like every character has, like, this is such a well-written film.
It really is.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So I love the character of Max. Now, as a kid, I did not understand that Max is a...
You didn't realize how much you had in common with Max? Yeah,
exactly. Yes. He's a confirmed bachelor who's into the arts. But so everybody loves Uncle Max, but he is, in some sense, he
gay
provides...
uncles are the best.
Yeah. He drives, in some sense, the plot, because he is forcing them. He basically, while the captain is not looking, he signs them up to sing, and he gets the kids singing. And so he is... He's not just a comic relief, although he does have some pretty funny lines. But I personally liked, you know, I have no political convictions. Can I help it if other people do? I thought that was good. He drives the plot forward. So that character, and there, he's in some scenes, but not a huge amount. But again, there's more depth to that character than I originally thought.
And he basically sacrifices himself because...
Oh, yeah.
It's not hard to surmise that... Yeah, Max is going to be killed.
The Nazis, who's the first person they're going to look to?
Yeah.
Right? And that's why...
Especially because specifically those soldiers know that Max helped them get out.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He's guilty.
Yeah.
And he's maybe a little gay. So the Nazis, yeah, he's not gonna do well. So that was great. The Baroness, when I was a kid, just evil.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, she was like the evil stepmother.
Cruella de Vil.
Yeah, yeah.
And watching
but she really
it again,
wasn't.
No, she was not warm. She was.
Well, she wasn't a kid person.
Right.
We see that scene where they're playing ball.
Right. She wasn't the Bellamy.
Right.
But she wasn't a kid person. She was just the wrong person.
Yeah.
But they. So as a kid, I kind of more saw her as like, ah,
yeah, totally.
But when you watch it now, it's like, oh, you're just not the right person. Right.
And it was almost like she wasn't, you know how it was so easy. It was such an easy trope to make her like mean to Maria.
Right.
She wasn't really even that mean to Maria. I mean, I think it was almost like she could see the writing on the wall and was kind of like, you won. You know, I mean, she was.
Well, and if you rewind the
or
gay,
did she do something?
Well, she did kind of tell, she told her that the captain had feelings or whatever. She did kind of outmaneuver her a little bit. But when you have to realize that the Baroness was a good match for the captain before Maria changed him, right? So the old captain, he would have loved to send the kids to boarding school and have a sleek yacht in the Mediterranean, all those things. So he changed and she got left behind. And so I thought the Baroness takes it with a decent amount of grace.
Yes, she does. Yes, right? She does.
So there's that. And then there's even the housekeeper who I loved the, well, I probably shouldn't be telling you this, but, uh-huh. Right? Very common, you know, for domestic help. They, you know, got a band together against the rich guy. The kids, each of the kids has a unique personality, right? And they don't actually have a huge amount of lines individually, but you know the different kids.
Yeah.
Just, wow. Really well written.
No, yeah. It was, as being someone who has been part of the staff, it makes so much sense that the housekeeper would kind of root for Maria because
right.
she's effective. The children have grown to like her. And so if we can keep her around, it's one less thing that will be changing. I mean, we heard, I can't remember the number, but the captain says how many governesses have kind of
right.
been coming through, or maybe that was a housekeeper. And so it's just going to be in her best interest for Maria to work out.
Right. They said one didn't make an hour or something. It was great.
Right.
There's some interesting cinematography, I thought. We talked already about lots and lots of helicopter footage, but there's two sets where I thought things were really quite interesting. One is the Reverend Mother's office. So it is almost entirely black.
Yeah, no it's lighting dark. In the convent, apparently.
Which seems a little unrealistic. If it's, it's where you work, you would want a little bit better lighting. Coincidentally, every mark that Julie Andrews stood on was lit. Huh. Interesting. But I read a bit of trivia that in the stage version that was put on before this, that song Climb Every Mountain was a bombastic, like very loud over the top version. And the director specifically went the other direction. And that's why it was so dark. And I bet he just continued that throughout that entire set. But it was strikingly dark. And there was just little tiny slivers that were really well lit. And as I thought about it some more, the nuns' habits are like that. They're mostly black with a little bit of white. So I thought, okay, all right, camera department, I'll give you that one. The other is that gazebo. I didn't know this until this time around, read the trivia. There is an exterior gazebo that they shot when they were outside the gazebo, but when you went inside for dancing and stuff, that was on a soundstage and it was much bigger. They blew it up.
Like an elevator.
Like an elevator. Got to have room for the camera and the actors to act. But we saw a couple of really fantastic things in there. So there's when Rolf and Liesl are in there, they're standing at different depths to the camera. And the camera op pulls and pushes focus as they deliver their lines. So when the audience is watching this film, watch that. It is incredibly well done. Just as they go back and forth, no cuts. They just focus. Boom, boom.
Wow.
Just
go. Especially back then.
Yeah, give him a high five. That's incredible. You mentioned that we saw this, that there's a silhouette of the captain and Maria in the doorway. And they did a lot of silhouettes in that, but that was especially gorgeous, I thought.
It was framed so beautifully.
Yeah. I mean, this is a case where I know that camera crews nowadays can do these things. It's not that they, but I feel like the style of filmmaking, we don't do that as much anymore. There's just some beautiful shots. And I love that gazebo. And then when they're running, right, on the, oh, just a lot of fun. Like,
you know, Liesl fell.
She did.
And twisted her ankle pretty bad. She even had to go to the hospital. And so I was looking. They say that in some scenes you can see her legs bandaged, her leg, but I didn't see it.
I read separately that in modern versions they've digitally taken it out. And so before she passed, the actress was a little bummed because people thought she was making it up because there was no evidence on screen anymore.
Oh.
Yeah. So I have to say a little side note, Charmian Carr, Liesl.
Yeah.
As a young viewer.
You had a thing for Liesl.
Absolutely gorgeous and voice of an angel.
Yes.
And then the last little bit I had was, I thought it was, it's not groundbreaking, but it was interesting. They have the music festival and it's in this giant, it almost looks like a Roman Colosseum.
Yeah.
And it's got all these levels and they put an extra in the Nazi brown shirt uniform in each of these little cubbies and they do this slow pan upward. And I thought that was brilliant because you would normally, that's technically a tilt, but you would normally pan left to right.
Yeah.
To show there's lots of Nazis.
Yeah.
But by tilting up, it gives the sense that they're above you. They're just, you're like at the bottom of this well. It was such a clever idea. I really enjoyed that from the camera department.
Yeah. The song Edelweiss was written for the musical and is little known in Austria, which is hard to believe.
Yeah, because it is so well known in the U.S.
Yeah. And the song was the last that Oscar Hammerstein II wrote before his death in 1960.
Yeah.
Little note, I told you this the other day, but while hiking in the Swiss Alps, we were singing Edelweiss.
Yes. Well, it's just the other side of the hill.
Right. Yeah. It felt appropriate to us.
Well, according to the movie, I think they hiked into the Swiss Alps. So you were just a little bit.
We were at the final scene.
Yeah. I don't know much about Catholicism.
Yes.
In particular, nuns' clothing.
Okay.
But I did notice a couple of things that stuck out.
Oh, you love you a Whipple.
Yeah. I'm pro Wimple. Now, speaking of lip sync battle, I would do total none.
A Man in a Habit is hilarious.
Inherently funny.
Just the by sight.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I think only if a la Jeffrey Tambor, you have to sell it. You can't camp it up. You just have to go completely fully in.
And the more facial hair, I think.
And the broader the shoulders.
Yes. Yeah. The better. Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know whether their habits were period correct or not.
Okay.
I noticed that they were mostly the same, but there were two differences. One sister had much more white on her upper torso. So I don't know if that was like a merit badge kind of thing where, you know, or are you like the like crossing the guard? Yeah. Like this week, you know, Sister Gladys is in charge of whatever. But then there's one, her skirt, her dress, like only went to mid calf.
No.
Yeah.
So, scandal.
The sexy nun.
I wonder if she hemmed it because she was the racy nun.
Yeah. Maybe she was new. They're getting her used to the full length.
Sister Sugarcane.
Nice callback. Or was that Jack Lemmon? I noticed that Maria had this leather cowboy hat that she wore when, like, as part of her civilian garb, but she wore it tilted back at a 45-degree angle. And I have never seen that before. The Voice, where I see...
It wasn't a cowboy hat. It had a straight brim. But it was like a Pharrell hat.
Yeah, but it was a hat with a wide brim.
Right, but it wasn't a cowboy hat.
Okay, fine. It wasn't a cowboy hat. I don't want to argue about different cowboy hats. It wasn't a Stetson. I'll give you that. My point is, she's wearing it tilted back at a 45-degree angle. This is kind of useless to keep the sun off of your face. It's great when you don't want your actress to be in shadow, but I've noticed that on The Voice, a lot of the girls who are country singers wear their hats at that 45 useless angle.
And so you can see your face.
So is that calling back? I've never seen that before. Maria did it. So is this a Maria Von Trapp thing?
No, it's just makes sense so you can see your face.
Yeah, well, I'm sure the camera department's like, we can't see your face. It's in shadow. Yeah. Tilt the hat back. Speaking, though, of that, did you notice that Maria had as a suitcase a carpet bag, which looked very reminiscent of the role she had just finished filming? And I also...
Was that period accurate, though?
It probably was. I did notice, as did you, that when she's traveling from the Abbey to the Von Trapps for the first time, that the guitar case and the carpet bag obviously have absolutely nothing in them.
Right.
So, okay, I got to take the sets, props people to the task for that. My last little bit here is I'm curious from a production standpoint, did they source or make the drapery hosen first and then make the drapes match or vice versa? Did they actually find drapes and then just go get that fabric and make the drapery hosen?
That's a wonderful question. Yeah. I actually found a handful of Sound of Music documentaries that I really intended on watching before we recorded this and unfortunately did not manage to squeeze them in. But I love this movie so much, I may still watch them. So yeah. I can report back if I find out anything.
But speaking of that, it would help if people sent lots of money. I mean, if this was like the Joe Rogan Experience in a cash cow, we'd have time to watch stuff before each episode. So just, you know, saying if people want more information, content. Yeah, they go ahead and throw some cash this way.
Was there any head trauma in The Sound of Music? Maybe to the little frog?
I said everyone seemed to be okay after falling out of the boat, but that was the closest that they came. Someone might have knocked a head as they fell out of that boat.
And I told you while we were watching that little Gretel couldn't swim, and so the plan was that she was Julie. As soon as they got knocked out of the boat, Julie would scoop up Gretel so that she wouldn't drown, and sadly... Julie went over the starboard side of the boat, and poor little Gretel went over the port side, luckily with some other siblings that rescued her. But Julie said to this day, she still feels bad that she let little Gretel down.
Well, and I did make a note that if this guy was a Navy captain, wouldn't he have a better boat?
Well, and shouldn't all his children know how to swim?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because...
Oh, but I guess it's the actor that didn't know how to swim.
Sailors...
It's just a movie, Christy.
They didn't teach sailors to swim for many, many, many years. And the thinking was that it's only useful if you're close to land. So if you're out in the middle of the ocean, swimming isn't going to help you. You're dead anyway.
At least gives you hope.
I know. I agree. Jeez. But I'm just telling you, that's what sailors were. They felt like, I guess, learning to swim was telling Neptune that you wanted to come visit.
And did Maria and the captain ever kiss?
Smoochy, smoochy, smoochy.
According to my notes, they smooch in the gazebo after he sends the Baroness packing.
Do Rolf and Liesl ever kiss?
I didn't note it.
That dirty Nazi Rolf.
Yeah, yeah.
And how about, does the Baroness get her clutches onto the captain before she leaves?
I don't believe she smooches him.
All right. Okay. Driving review, please.
Okay, so first thing that we notice is the 1953 Steyr Diesel 380 bus did not have guitar-width doors. Maria couldn't get out of the bus with that guitar case. So needed the captain and his family, they have a black 1937 Mercedes-Benz 540K convertible. That is a high-end vehicle. It shows that he's running with the money. But when he's driving Max and the Baroness to the estate for the first time, Christopher Plummer doesn't turn the steering wheel, even though the background behind them on the green screen does in fact turn. They should have given him a cue. Left turn, Christopher. Straighten out. So, again, don't know how many people noticed that. Only those who watch time codes. And I have to say, there's a 1938 Horch 853. I didn't recognize it. Had to look that up. It's the car that the Nazis drive. Boy, did it corner really well at speed. I don't know if you saw that, but that bad boy was heeling over pretty far to the side. I guess the Nazis were in a hurry. It didn't take anything slow. But then the funniest thing is, they have a French car for a getaway. That's a Citroën that they pack in 9 people. Now, I understand that 7 of them were children, but 9 people in that little French car.
I know. I thought of that when they all started. It very much is a clown car at that point.
Yeah, it is. And, okay, I don't know that model of Citroën, but I believe at that time, the little French cars, they didn't have a lot of horsepower. So 9 people? That's easily 1,000 pounds. I don't know how fast they're going to flee the Nazis in that thing.
They all put their feet down.
Oh, yeah, they could Fred Flintstone it.
The real Maria Von Trapp said in interviews that she fell in love with the children and saw marrying the captain as the best way to become a permanent part of the children's lives. She said at first she merely liked her new husband and only learned to love him over the years.
Right.
Shall we go to the numbers?
Let's go to the numbers.
This movie had a budget of $8.2 million, which I would think in 1965
that's
was a chunk of change. It made $163 million domestically, and worldwide it made $286 million. And that may be today's dollars.
Well, what is $8 million in $65 today?
I don't know, because yeah. I didn't have... Oh, here, I can maybe find that out.
How much is per dollar?
Okay, it says... $100. Well, basically, it's $1,000. For every $100, it's $1,000.
Okay, so that's an $80 million budget.
Yeah, so the $80 million today.
Okay.
Wow. Okay, it gets an 8.1 out of 10 on IMDb. Wow, critics only gave it an 83%.
How is this movie rated lower than Some Like It Hot? That doesn't make any sense to me.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Audiences love it much more at 91%, so they clearly give it an 8. I would think that would have been higher too, though, like 95, yeah. 96.
Yeah, there's some haters out there.
Yeah, maybe it's because it is 2 hours and 55 minutes.
Well, that's true.
It is rated G. Like we said, the whole family can go. It is listed as a biography drama family movie. It was put on by Argyle Enterprises and Robert Wise Productions. It won 5 Oscars. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Sound, Best Editing, Best Score.
Okay.
So Robert Wise accepted for Best Picture. It also won 18 other awards and 13 other nominations. And like I said, it is available on Disney Plus. So, I mean, it's just a classic. You cannot go wrong with Sound of Music.
You cannot.
If you have 3 hours, that is about the only knock against it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I have to say, it is double the moral line, but there wasn't a point in there where I said, oh,
I'd be curious,
it's dragging. Like, let's cut this down.
Right, right. What he would say. All right, let's see what we're going to watch next week.
Inside Man.
All right. Everybody, have a great rest of your weekend, and never forget,
Dodges never stop, and neither do the movies.
Thanks for listening to Dodge Movie Podcast with Christy and Mike Dodge of Dodge Media Productions. To find out more about this podcast and what we do, go to dodgemediaproductions.com. Subscribe, share, leave a comment, and tell us what we should watch next. Dodges never stop, and neither do the movies.